Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck and Robert Bound.
Today we're looking at the inner workings of the mind, not what we think but how we feel. Neuroscientist and author Antonio Damasio will be joining us to talk through his book, The Strange Order of Things.
We'll also be learning about more biological feats with freediver Hanley Prinsloo. The South African athlete and conservationist can hold her breath for 6 minutes and thinks lessons from the sport can benefit not only our own health and well-being, but maybe also the wider ocean too.
And we'll be meeting Katie Arnander, Director of Artistic Programming at London Sadler's Wells Theatre. She'll be discussing the space's upcoming season and why it's going flamenco for the start of 2018.
That's all to come, plus Monocle's Henry Rees-Sheridan will be cutting a rug through the crowded dance floor of current affairs. And there'll be more music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Andrew, it was beautiful, cold, crisp and even in London this week. It felt like winter has come back with a vengeance. But are you, this Sunday, feeling as warm as toast and ready to rock and roll for the Monocle Weekly?
I'm hot.
Are you?
Yeah,
you're
I'm
looking
hot.
It.
Hot,
looking
ready
it.
To rock.
how many layers do you tend to wear? For your audio knitwear, this is a phrase that I think was coined by our eminent editor-in-chief a while back on this show. He talked about winter knitwear. What's your sort of favourite attire for the Sunday radio broadcast?
I've got a thick jumper and a nice kind of like woolly plaid shirt.
Yeah.
I'm feeling actually an additional layer.
When you say you're feeling it, I mean, I'd like to tell listeners you are sort of, you're certainly feeling
I'm rubbing my jumper. It's nice and soft.
Yeah.
But I could have done with an additional, I'm a multi-layer man.
Yeah.
Should we just give one quick plug to your film? You've made a lovely film about Hauser and Wirth, this amazing art gallery down Somerset, isn't it?
Down in Somerset, Hauser and Wirth. In Bruton, in Somerset.
Yeah, I briefly popped in over Christmas. Amazing. And then it turned out you were making a film about it.
Yeah.
It's worth watching just for the Apple Man.
He's great. The artist Marcus Coates, who kind of dresses as a shaman, as a sort of modern take, as an old-fashioned take on the Apple Store and the Apple, what do they call them? The Apple Service Provider, the Genius Bar, all this kind of thing. So, yeah, so he dresses from head to foot in this amazing Apple costume that he made himself at home, brought carefully to Bruton, and will, if you go on the right day, dispense Apple logic to you in an anchorite cell on campus there. But generally, the whole show is amazing. It's about rurality, the land we live in, the land we left behind, matters of rural nature, rural culture. It's good stuff.
The film section of Monocle.com is the place to head. I wouldn't want to do that job in the summer, though, because wasps, I don't like wasps, and I think they like apples. They'd be like all over you, like a rash. And talking of rashes...
like a beard of bees.
Talking of rashes, should we bring in Henry Rees-Sheridan?
Hi, Henry.
Hello. Do you know what? It's interesting that you should mention both rural life and art in your introduction, because I'm going to touch upon both of those topics in the news look ahead. We're going to begin with art. On Monday, the 12th of February, tomorrow, portraits of Barack and Michelle Obama are going to be unveiled at the Smithsonian's National Portrait Gallery. Mm-hmm. Now, this is a tradition that goes back... Basically, the gallery has a complete collection of presidential portraits, but since George H.W. Bush, they've actually specially commissioned artists to do portraits of the outgoing president and first lady.
Very fine artists they've chosen this time around, I think.
They have, yeah. So Kehinde Wiley is going to become the first African-American to paint the presidential portrait, and Michelle Obama's portrait is going to be painted by another African-American artist called Amy Sherald.
Kehinde Wiley's an amazing artist, yeah. He's one of David Werner's artists, and he kind of riffs on European tradition, kind of like Dutch Golden Age and kind of Renaissance portraiture and all the rest of it. He's amazing with colour, and he's amazing with kind of texture and all the rest of it. And they're quite emotional, quite kind of pumped up. Look at this. This is amazing. You're showing us a picture
I brought in handouts.
Michael Jackson on a horse, a bit sort of like Napoleon.
Yeah, and that was actually the last commissioned portrait of Michael Jackson before he died. So I'm very interested to see what he's going to do with Obama. I also want to mention Amy Sherald, because she is really relatively unknown, or yeah. was at least before this election, compared to Wiley. And Michelle and Obama, we should say, each picked their own artist from a shortlist selected by the Smithsonian. And apparently Sherald was only added onto the shortlist at the very last minute. So it's a remarkable turn of events for
She's
her.
She's like the wild card that won the Grand Slam.
Indeed, yeah. yeah. I'm really looking forward to seeing what those portraits bring.
Yeah, that'd be good stuff.
Should we move on to the rural? That was the art section. So I know that Andrew likes to take every opportunity he can get to talk about his nest box. And this week is annual national in the UK Nest Box Week. Now, I said this is rural. It's not strictly rural, is it? Because I think some of the best nest boxes can be found in urban areas. Indeed, that's where they're needed most frequently. But, Andrew, maybe you can take it from here.
Well, the weird thing is, because I've never told you this, but last Sunday I could be found... I live in central London. I only have a small roof terrace. But I could be found on the roof terrace drilling in our first bird box.
Really? That was the first installation?
Yeah, I was given... I've never had a bird box in my life. And then by coincidence, two people gave me a bird box at Christmas.
At the same time?
At the same time. And actually both at the same big Christmas party down the country. And one of them runs a garden centre who gave it to me. And the other person had gone shopping at their garden centre and bought it. So they're both from the same place. Anyway, so I can do like a terrace row of bird boxes on my terrace. Apparently, the important thing is, you know, because I've also got a very nice bird feeder on my terrace, which is very busy. You shouldn't put a bird box near a bird feeder. Because,
why?
I think it's because there's too much kind of confusion going on outside the nest and too much passing traffic. And it kind of puts off the birds inside.
They're extremely sensitive, aren't they?
Yeah, you have to find a good shelter position.
They need their territory.
Yeah. So I'm hoping we get blue tits, we get great tits, we've got a robin. When I was out there putting the bird box up, the robin was kind of like only a foot away watching because they're so tame. It's so I'm all excited. I'm all a flutter about what's going to end up in my box.
I like it.
Genuinely informative broadcasting.
I thought when Andrew started telling us that anecdote, he was going to say I could have been seen on my roof terrace last Saturday afternoon, dressed as a giant woodpecker, trying to encourage other birds in to my bird box. But no.
Excellent. And finally, on the 14th of February, next Wednesday, it's Ash Wednesday. But there's this tradition in Germany, I don't know when it begun, it's called Political Ash Wednesday, and basically the leaders of all the main parties...
Inevitably they've got one of those.
Exactly. kind of... It's the end of Carnival as well in Germany, which is quite a big thing over there. Yeah. And basically all the leaders of the main parties arrange meet-ups where everyone's kind of dressed in traditional gear, drinking beer. It looks a lot like Oktoberfest.
Because they like France as well, very into Candlemas, which was last week, wasn't it? So this is a sort of post-Epiphany kind of part of the Christian calendar.
Exactly. It's still a hangover from the Christian calendar, but it is quite a big political event. And last year, a lot of snipes were being taken. I think it's a kind of it's an opportunity for the political leaders to really kind of snipe at other political leaders in a kind of semi-personal. Do you know what I mean? Take the gloves off a little bit because it's a bit of a festive atmosphere. It will be interesting to see what happens this year, obviously, because it comes very recently off the tails of the agreement of the coalition in Germany, which is being seen as a massive concession from Merkel. She's ended up in exactly the same coalition that German voters voted against in the election over 4 months ago.
So there's a bit of a flavour of like the press dinner at the White House kind of thing with it, where people, it's an official thing, but everyone can kind of free themselves up a bit. So it's people saying what they really think for a change.
Well, like that, except each leader attends their own party event. So I think it's a better gauge of the temperature within the parties. And, you know, it's still interesting in that regard because Martin Schulz, the SPD leader, took a huge amount of heat from his own party over these coalition talks. But then maybe Merkel is also going to be relatively unpopular in her party as well. So keep your eye out to see what happens.
Political Ash Wednesday it is. Thank you for telling us what's going to happen next week, Henry.
Antonio Damasio is director of the Brain and Creativity Institute at the University of Southern California, and his latest book looks at the science behind that most instinctual element of life, feelings.
Damasio's new book, The Strange Order of Things, argues that feelings have not been given the credit they deserve as motives, monitors and negotiators of human cultural endeavours. And he joins us on the line from California now to discuss it. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Antonio. And let's start, first of all, this feels like finally you are giving the heart the credence it deserves over the sometimes boring old head. Am I right?
In a way, yes. Yeah, I'm really trying to give the life of affect the credit that it deserves, not only in the running of our everyday life, but the creation of something that is easily one of the most important of human aspects, which is the creation of cultural practices and cultural instruments.
For people who are new to this, it can seem like a large thought, but you give many really sharp examples. Now, one of the things you talk about, for example, is that it's only because humans feel pain and get hurt that there becomes a desire, or in part there becomes the desire to heal ourselves, which it led in a way to the discovery of medicine. So we may think of medicine as a purely intellectual pursuit of great minds thinking about how to cure various diseases. But actually, you show that here's a very clear example. Here's a place where our feelings and our intellect combined for a positive outcome.
Exactly. So I think the fundamental idea is that if we did not have to cope with suffering and pain, which are, of course, feelings, and if we did not have the prospect of exactly the opposite, which is well-being and pleasure, we would not have had a motivation to apply our intellect to the development of a variety of things, which includes very prominently medicine. You know, it's a very central technology, let's say, now combined with science, but it's very old, and it has to do with the confrontation that a person has with his or her own pains and suffering, and the confrontation that another human being will have with the one that has pains or suffering, and that duo, the patient and the healer physician, were the beginning of medicine. And curiously, there was affect on both sides. There was the sufferer on the one hand, and on the other, there was the person that had sympathy or compassion for the one that suffered. And very often, as you just said, we simply see this as an exercise of one's wits around the creation of solving a diagnostic puzzle or creating an adequate treatment. But it's more than that, or it's less than that to begin with. It's this confrontation with affect that is disturbed and is in the negative direction as opposed to the positive one. And of course, this applies to many other aspects. And by the way, when I mention cultures in the book, of course, I list certain areas that are fundamental. So I list, for example, the arts in general, probably beginning with music, but then also the discovery, quote unquote, of moral systems, of governance, of, for example, religious belief, and eventually technology and science. So all of those main areas of cultural development were clearly pushed forth by the presence of feelings of one sort or another. Pain and suffering clearly dominate. Once again, the prospect of well-being, the prospect of the positive, was a very important factor, clearly.
It's fascinating stuff, Antonio. Are you saying that there are not just feelings, what we might call simple neurological feelings, things that shoot up the up your spinal column, like pleasure and pain, but we also, and maybe it's a more sophisticated feeling, is right and wrong? Do feelings have a morality or at a neurological level, or is that something we lay upon them?
Well, it's interesting. I think that feeling is a very important foundation for any aspect of moral behavior. But of course, morality doesn't come out of simple feeling. Morality is, in the proper sense, is an intellectual elaboration that has feelings at the root. For example, when you decide, when we decided as human beings long ago, that killing another person or making another person suffer was a bad thing, we had feelings to guide us. The reason why killing another person or making another person suffer is bad is because you see another person that is suffering, so that is about feeling, and you yourself either have or do not have the feelings that correspond to that particular state. So it's inconceivable to have a moral system without a root in feeling. And things that have to do with the dignity of another person, for example, the things that have to do with, say, the consequences of something like stealing or betraying another, all of those states, actions, and consequences can be described in a dispassionate intellectual way, but in fact are important in our lives and are a central part of our lives precisely because they involve either the suffering or the well-being of other people, including our own, of course.
You're a professor of neuroscience, psychology, and philosophy, so you sit in the middle of all of this debate. Now, many of the reviews and many of the comments about your work recently have said, you know, that it's kind of revolutionary. It changes the way that we think about ourselves. Could you articulate for us why it is revolutionary? Is it because you're challenging some of the presumptions that we know from the world of philosophy, that you are trying to reposition what humans are?
I guess so. You know, I didn't think of myself as a revolutionary in this sense. I think it's so obvious that it shouldn't be revolutionary. On the other hand, I understand why people say so, and I'm very grateful that they recognize that, because there is no doubt that the weight of the treatment of humans by thinking in general, by philosophy, but not just philosophy, by the general intellectual atmosphere, is to give weight to what is objective and rational and clear-cut. We look at a society and a culture, we look at human beings, trying to be as knowledgeable and as rational as we can. We prize rationality, and I do prize rationality, obviously. But the fact is that that only tells half the story of what a human being is. One part, a very important part of our human lives revolves around very, very precise processes, such as, for example, our perception, you know, say visual or auditory, or our intellectual elaboration of what things are or not, the reasons for things, the causes of certain phenomena, for example. And science has illuminated that beautifully. We also have the precisions that come from the way we make our memories, the way we manipulate our memories, and from the language that we are using. You know, I here and you over there, we are using this very precise system of communication, and there's nothing terribly vague about it. We have to be precise in order to be able to send these signals across. On the other hand, people forget that all of this sits in a very soft but very important foundation of being. And that foundation of being turns out to be the foundation of our affects. There's another life on the side of all this precision of our intellect that has to do with, for example, our moods. Do you wake up full of energy and looking forward to your life, or do you wake up sad and despondent? Are you awake or asleep? All these cycles that have to do with the amount of energy you have. All of that operation is really the foundational operation for who we are. And it's an operation that is really the life of feelings, the life of sentiments that portray the state of our living creature. And that is a very old foundation, by the way. The reason why the book is called The Strange Order of Things is that I'm making a connection between our sophisticated life of the intellect and that less sophisticated life that goes all the way down to creatures with single cells. And so that appears revolutionary because it goes against the grain. But, of course, I'm not the first person to call attention to the importance of feelings. I think it's just a very good moment to insist on it, given in particular the enormous weight that is now given, for example, to computational theories of mind and the fact that we are being extremely attracted to things such as artificial intelligence and robots. And one thing that I definitely want to make clear is that even with all the successes of artificial intelligence and robotics, we are not robots. We are something that is quite different, and it needs to have, you know, its full appreciation.
Just finally before we go, I wanted to ask you, Antonio, about the idea of gut feeling, and someone alluded to this in talking about your book, in fact, and that you say, and we have the idea that gut feeling means pure instinct, and I know that you might give me a definition of instinct, which is about it is lots of acquired learning that we're able to access very quickly, but there's also a negative idea to the instinctive somehow. But you say something very interesting, that the gut, the belly, the stomach, might in fact have basically been the first brain we ever had. And if you know it in your gut, then you know it for a fact. Maybe you can expand briefly on that.
Well, first is the fact that historically, from point of view of evolution, the part of the nervous system that surrounds and operates the gut is in fact the first brain. Somebody has called it the second brain, but it's not the second, it's the first. Because when you go back to creatures that had the first nervous systems, a lot of them were creatures whose body was fundamentally an intestine. So they were what I call in the book sort of floating digestive systems. And the very first things that nervous systems were able to do is peristalsis, is the ability to make the gut move along so that food could move along in that tract. So it's a very old system. And what we have now, all the glories of spinal cord, brain stem, and the telencephalon, all of this came later in evolution. Now, the other aspect is that very often when we emote, when we are confronted with the something that makes us panic or makes us apprehensive, we respond to that emotion, which of course produces the feeling of fear. We respond to that emotion not only intellectually, but very early on we respond to it by having something that we refer to the gut. People normally feel fear and anxiety with a response that comes from the gut and a response that may come, for example, from the respiratory system. We feel when we talk about anxiety, we talk about a sort of feeling of strangulation that you have in your airway. Even the terms which describe our affective states are terms that always refer to the body, and for a very good reason, is that the body is being affected and is being changed by those particular intellectual contents. So what happens is that if there is something that ought to cause apprehension to us, we may feel, rather than having a full recognition of the situation, we may feel first a response that happens to be in the gut. That's what is called a gut feeling, and people can call it gut instinct. It's not really instinct. It's actually much more interesting than that. It's sort of a result of our big data upper brain scanning past memories and sensing very rapidly that there's something amiss, something that may be going wrong, and we don't know it yet because we have not been able to fully intellectualize the situation. And yet, because of our past connection with many such situations, the gut responds. And that response is a way of alerting us to the danger that may be ahead. So it's once again to make the point that we are not a sort of marvelous intellectual machines that are computing everything in the way that artificial intelligence actually does. We do it in an older way. We do it in a way that exposes this very integral connection of mind in the proper sense and of a much older body that has been here for not only millions but billions of years, evolving with all of these different components and structures. And make no mistake, the brain, important as it is one part of a living organism, and it's a part of a living organism that is in charge of regulating that organism and trying to make the best for it, but it is not it completely. You know, there's more to a living organism than just the brain.
Thank you very much. It's fascinating stuff. The book is The Strange Order of Things. It is out now. The author, the one and only Antonio Damasio, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Time for some music now. This is new from Canada. It's producer-songwriter Mormor, also known as Seth Nyquist, with Heaven's Only Wishful.
I'm just a poor boy.
More there with Heaven's Only Wishful. And very nice indeed it was. Well, you're listening to the Monocle Weekly. Hanley Prinsloo is a former competitive freediver from South Africa who's now looking to educate people about how to conserve the undersea environment via her I Am Water Foundation. And she knows a thing or two about survival beneath the waves. She's able to hold her breath up to 6 minutes.
Earlier on, Monocle's Tom Hall spoke to Hanley for a crash course in freediving and to learn more about her current work.
Tell me a little bit about the technicality of doing this sport. We're not recommending anyone jumps in the water and does it with no training, but for someone who would be interested in it, tell us about the technicalities of what goes on. What's the difference between just diving in and doing a technical freedive?
Freediving has actually been around much longer than the competitive sport of freediving has been. I mean, it's been a very specific way for humans to live off the ocean. So from early pearl divers in Japan, the Ama divers who dived for shellfish and pearls, to, you know, Moken people in the spear hunting traditions of hunting fish underwater, all the way down to Polynesians. So freediving's been around for a very, very long time as a way of living off the ocean. As a competitive sport, freediving is still quite new, actually, and quite niche. So it's about holding your breath and going as deep, as far, or as long as possible on one single breath of air. And it can get really, really technical, minutes, seconds, all those things that we measure. And I did spend over 10 years in that competitive world. Freediving really is any time you take one breath and leave the surface. That's the difference between snorkeling and freediving. And then you can get as technical as you want and how deep you want to go. But for me, I think I'm more interested in how comfortable people can be in the water to get to explore what's down there. I spent a lot of time swimming up and down a rope and now choose not to do that anymore and rather interact with sea animals.
Is it really a case that you today could jump in the water and go for a free swim for around 5 minutes? Could you still do that at the moment, or is that something you have to train over many months to get right?
Yes, I think I could, not here in the UK, but in a warm water destination, I spend enough time being in the water and practicing things like yoga and lung stretching and deep breathing that I've kept that going for myself. So I think I could probably do that still today, thank goodness. And the amazing thing is that the human body is fantastically adapted for freediving. I think because we breathe air, we believe we are true terrestrial creatures, but in fact, we have more in common with whales and dolphins and seals than we do with many land animals.
Talk me through a freedive. How does it work, professional or otherwise? What's the first thing that a freediver has to sort of get right?
The first thing for freediving, I think, is breathing properly. we would always think that freediving is about holding your breath, which it is in practice. But to be really good at it, it's about how you breathe. So the main thing is most people breathe with only the top part of their lungs and we sit quite closed in. When you start breathing and deepening your breath into more of a belly breath, you start oxygenating properly. So the first thing would always be to start breathing properly and oxygenating properly. And if your lungs are bigger, which you can stretch them to be, it's like putting a bigger engine in a car. And then taking those deep, slow breaths and then learning and knowing how to take a really big breath. So starting in your stomach, building into your chest, all the way up into your shoulders, one can take much more than you think you can of air and then dive down. And once you leave the surface and start diving down, it becomes very mental. It's a very, very mental sport. It's about staying relaxed, even though you're in this, what could be considered foreign environment, where you might have the urge to breathe before you're back at the surface. So it's mentally staying relaxed and also trusting these responses our body have that are completely autonomous. So we have a mammalian dive response, like whales and dolphins and seals. So when we step into water and dive down on one breath, your body does the same thing that a seal's body does.
It's interesting the thing you said about it being mental, because I imagine there's a capacity to obviously be able to panic in that situation. Have you learnt things from freediving that you've managed to transpose into everyday life about staying calm and kind of, you know, you mentioned you do yoga, and is there a sort of mindfulness to freediving, to the mentality of it?
Oh, absolutely. I think freediving, I believe, is like the epitome of mindfulness practice. It brings together the physical expression of yoga, for example, with the deep mindfulness of meditation. It brings all those things together and then pushes it right to its sharp end. So when you're underwater holding your breath, unnecessary thoughts use oxygen. So you need to know how to control your mind. Otherwise, you are wasting oxygen. I always feel that the more I can be water Hunley on land, the better I am at life. So I try to be more myself that I am in water. And the person I am in water moves slowly, thinks slowly, behaves with complete trust and openness.
I saw a talk that you did where you talked about your fondness for sharks. Have you ever been around these creatures during these dives, and how have you interacted with sharks when you're under the sea?
I have both voluntarily and involuntarily interacted with sharks. Involuntarily, when you're on a surfboard. I think when you have a mask on and fins and you're underwater in clear water, you can really have very positive and safe interactions with sharks. They are wildly misunderstood and badly cast characters in a horror show that doesn't exist.
Right.
I've swum with tiger sharks, I've encountered great white sharks, bull sharks, hammerhead sharks, all of the big four, five, however many there are that are really large. The main thing with sharks is, like most things that are potentially risky, is knowledge. Understanding the animal, understanding its behavior, understanding its environment. Where am I getting in the water? Is this an area where the shark feeds? Is this an area where the visibility is bad enough that I could be considered food? And with that knowledge, you can adjust your choices and have safe encounters.
You have a foundation, I Am Water, which is a sort of conservation-minded foundation. Tell us a little bit about that work and some of the projects you've been working on.
I started I Am Water out of a place of great sadness around how ocean experience have become very elitist. In my country, in South Africa, straight down the race line, you have those not only who have wealth, but who have access to experiences. And I Am Water tries to bridge that gap on the experience level. So we offer ocean experience and ocean conservation workshops for children from very poor areas who live within walking distance from the ocean. Imagine growing up your whole life being able to see this vast wilderness, but never having the opportunity to experience it. And then we have the absolute audacity to judge people who don't make the right choices with regards to litter or protecting the ocean if they've never been given the opportunity to experience it. So in I Am Water, we work with seventh graders. We take them out of school. We take them to the beach. Many of them have never even been to the beach. And we offer workshops that begin with stretching, yoga, mindfulness practice, deep breathing, understanding their own bodies, understanding the rocky shore, seeing the rock pools, doing a beach cleanup, understanding where litter comes from, why it's so bad for the ocean, and then taking them snorkeling and actually seeing their eyes open underwater for the first time is mind-blowing. That's what gets me up every morning.
Can you articulate that a little bit? Because many people would assume that if the sea is there, if you want, you can get in it. But when you say that people don't have access to it, do you mean that's because in the California coast, we see much beautiful coastline and it's kind of bought by property owners and stuff? Yeah. What's the issue that's stopping people just getting in the sea, which many people would assume was just a given or a birthright?
Totally. So the lack of access to oceans in South Africa, and it's different in different parts of the world. In South Africa, it's several things. In some cases, even though you're only 5 kilometers away, which can seem very close, without any transport or something, then you're quite far away, even though your taxi goes past it every day, back and forth. And taxi, I mean, like in South Africa, it's little minibuses full of people. Yeah. So there's that one thing, the geographical thing. But more than anything, it's during the apartheid time in South Africa, beaches and oceans were for whites only. So there's been several generations that have had no experience of the ocean, no training in swimming, no understanding the ocean, the rip currents, the waves, the beach. I mean, we have one of the highest drowning rates in the world. So that during the holiday season, where people actually do go to the beach, they don't know how to do it safely. So in every family, there's a story of somebody who's drowned. So the good parents would tell their kids, don't go to the beach.
Right.
So that can come from a self-censorship within the communities, because the ocean is a dangerous place.
Yeah.
Because for generations and generations, it hasn't been, again, accessible to this demographic.
This has taken you now to Petite St. Vincent. Tell me a little bit about what's going on there.
So it's an absolute privilege to be able to go to an area that is a complete protected area. There's not many places like that in the world. It's been built around the ethos of conservation and of understanding what that means and trying to create a holistic conservation. And it's a really exciting opportunity for us to see how that works in practice, to see how an area that is managed for those reasons from that ethos flourishes. And it does flourish. I mean, there is incredible marine life and biodiversity and opportunity for the ecology to recover from an area that hasn't been very protected in the past. So it is a fantastic opportunity to see that in practice, to see the things I speak about, I write about, I dream about, conservation in its holistic sense, actually practiced in one place.
Is there an argument to say that really we humans should not be poking around down there at all, because you see things like coral reefs being eroded and things like that? I mean, how do you dive responsibly?
There's definitely a way to keep exploring the ocean and doing it responsibly. Freediving's, I think, a fantastic way to do that. Scuba divers who do it well and do it carefully can also do it, but it's more equipment. And it's just a bigger industry, so it's harder to regulate. No, I don't think that it's a solution to completely not explore the ocean. I think if you wanted to be that hard-lined, you could rather stop eating fish. But you can definitely still keep exploring the ocean,
yeah,
for sure. I mean, don't, you know, pick up shellfish and take them with you, and don't pull off corals. But the greatest threats to our ocean are definitely not connected with humans exploring them. That's for sure not. I think, on the contrary, I think the more people who get to explore the ocean and see both its beauty, but also understand its fragility, will have a deeper change and a more long-lasting transformation in behavior. I mean, you can't visit coral reefs like the ones around Petite St. Vincent and not feel compelled to change how your behavior would affect coral bleaching, for example. Once you've seen a coral bed that used to be completely vibrant, devoid of color and dead. And I mean, corals are animals, right? This is what's so mind-boggling. These are animals. So when you see the skeletons of these animals and you understand, gosh, this is part of climate change. This is what happens if we don't take care of the planet. Everything gets affected. I think it's really important that people keep exploring and seeing and understanding. And there are definitely ways to do that sustainably. We can move the needle through the choices we make as consumers. And that's incredibly important and empowering. Instead of feeling like I can't do anything, it's like, yes, you can. Where are you going on holiday?
Yeah.
how do they respond to these challenges? So in that way, I think Petite St. Vincent is leading the charge in that, and so is I'm Water Ocean Travel. And I think that's what makes this partnership both authentic and really powerful.
People associate luxury with a lot of excess because obviously the word itself implies, you know, more is more. I mean, how does that sort of fit into a green-minded approach to tourism and to running a resort? I mean, how do those two things line up next to each other?
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned that. I think in the last few years, and I believe moving forwards, the word luxury, especially when it comes to facilities like islands and resorts, is changing. This idea of opulence is definitely changing. Today, we live in concrete jungles. We don't feel dirt. We don't have mud on our boots anymore. So I think luxury is having unobstructed access to nature, to wilderness. That is true luxury. Not the opulence around you, not how fantastic the facilities are. It's being in a place where you have access to this incredible nature and it's yours to enjoy and only yours to enjoy for this time. That is true luxury. And that's where I think a place like Petite St. Vincent really captures that, because you have this whole island to yourself to experience this natural beauty and get out of that concrete that we live in.
Finally, what's one thing that everyone could do to make the oceans a much more pleasant place for both humans and animals and everyone who uses them in the future?
When it comes to personal behavior changes for ocean conservation, there's been a lot of talk lately around single-use plastic, which is important. Spending 6 months of the year in ocean locations, remote ocean locations, I have seen this increase in my short life and short career. I don't think 15 years in the wild oceans is a long time, and I've seen the changes. So definitely, that's one for sure. But another one that's not as comfortable maybe to talk about is what we eat. The reality is that 70% of all fish stocks around the world are overfished. What that means is beyond the point of recovery. So just eating whatever fish is put in front of you cannot be allowed anymore. Find out, what is this fish? How was it caught? And how is its family doing? And if you can't answer those three questions, don't eat it.
That was Hanley Prinsloo speaking to Monocle's Tom Hall, and you are tuned in to the Monocle Weekly. Sadler's Wells Theatre in London is the go-to space for innovative and challenging dance, and it's starting things off in 2018 with its annual showcase of flamenco.
The Flamenco Festival London kicks off on the 14th of February and continues right up until the 25th. And joining us to talk us through it and what else is coming up throughout the year is Katie Arnanda, Director of Artistic Programming at Sadler's Wells. 15 years of a relationship with the world of flamenco, and the list of performances coming this year covers everything from more traditional pieces through to people having a more playful take on what it means to be flamenco. Why is this strong passion between Sadler's Wells and this world of flamenco?
Well, I think flamenco, of all the dance forms, at Sadler's Wells, we present all dance forms, contemporary dance, ballet, flamenco, hip-hop, Katak, all kinds. But I think flamenco, it's 15 years now, and it never ceases to amaze me that it continues to be incredibly popular. And it's a two-week festival every year for the past 15 years that nearly always completely sells out. And I think one of the factors about flamenco that's so appealing to people coming to Sadler's Wells is that it's got fantastic music, fantastic dance. It can be very contemporary flamenco, it can be very traditional, more sometimes balletic flamenco, but also the music's fantastic. And I think that's why we get sort of lots of different audiences coming. You get the regular dance aficionados, but also you get people who come for the virtuosic music, I suppose.
What makes something flamenco? Is it a beat? Is it the music that defines it?
I think it's more to do with the culture from which it comes, which is rooted in a sort of gypsy, traditional flamenco gypsy communities based in Spain. One of the key things they use for the music is the guitar, and for the beat is something called the cajon, which is a box that's beaten. And of course, the singing, you have this very, very soulful singing, and of course the dancing, which is a lot of footwork, a lot of upper body remaining still, a lot of speedy footwork, but running through it all is this thing called the duende, which is a sort of Spanish word which sort of means passion or emotion. So it has to be filled with emotion, which is actually why often we don't have intervals in the shows, because once the artists start, they're off and they're on their own personal journey with the art and with the music.
And I noticed that this kicks off on the 14th of February.
Yes.
Is that a coincidence? Because it is full of passion, it's full of romance, this thing. It would be a great date. am I being, even for my taste, too simplistic?
No, it's a great date. In fact, it's wonderful.
It starts
on the 14th of February. And yeah, I think...
You've been wise there.
We have. You should arrive at the theatre and have a large glass of Rioja and sit down and just let the passion flow over you and romance might blossom with the date, possibly.
Yeah, but it is about that, isn't it? There is something we set up Saddler's Wells as also being the home of challenging dance and contemporary dance and all the ways in which that manifests itself, of which obviously flamenco is as well. But there is something gettable, I suppose, about flamenco because it does have that passion, it has that rhythm, as Andrew was saying. It's something that anyone of any age can kind of do without having to read about it, I suppose.
Definitely. And I think it's really interesting what you say about Saddler's Wells putting on challenging dance, because even within the flamenco world, the programme that we've got this year has actually got some quite, they would say, contemporary flamenco pieces, which are quite challenging.
You would imagine that, you know, the way the world changes and how many young dancers in Spain even would want to be pulled into more traditional ballet or contemporary dance or have international careers. It's amazing how vibrant it is when you look through the list of people coming to you.
It is. I think that's really interesting because I think you'll always have the purists, and that's what's interesting about the flamenco audience. The purists will really not be enjoying perhaps some of the more radical contemporary takes on flamenco. But then you've got the people who are passionate about the form and who are fascinated and enjoy seeing it being pushed and moved in different directions. And of course, that's what's happened to ballet. In fact, that's what happens in contemporary dance. And so it's something at Saddler's Wells that we embrace and welcome all the time, which is challenging the traditional, while having a very big respect and nod to the traditional, because that's where these forms are born, aren't they?
And we've used that word challenging a lot. You've used it, we've used it, we used it in the introduction. It's almost like we're playing a drinking game here. is that something that you, I mean, you know, you, as I said, you've used that word as well. That's something that you're happy to be, to sort of stand for and the theatre to stand for. Is it sometimes a bit of a weight round the neck, though, that you kind of go, come on, this stuff's great. It might be challenging in inverted commas. The newspapers might tell you it's that and all the rest of it. But actually, this stuff's accessible. It is people moving on stage. The music is rhythmic. The people are performing amazing feats, physical feats, and it's beautiful and it's soulful and all the rest of it. You sometimes feel that that's a bit of, oh God, you know, I don't want to talk about the challenging anymore.
I'm glad you said that, because I think there is a place for everything and for everyone. And I think our programme at Saddler's Wells sort of throughout the year reflects that, actually, which is it has pieces that are more conceptual, less linear in how you get into them. And then it has pieces that are and works that are incredibly accessible. So, for example, our summer show is a musical Cuban version of Carmen called Carmen La Cubana, also another Spanish-speaking piece, actually. And that's filled with fantastic Cuban music and fantastic salsa, a band on stage, and the story of Carmen, but set in Havana. And that sort of work isn't challenging in the traditional sense, but it's, again, twisting Carmen into a sort of interesting setting. And we have plenty of shows down at the Peacock Theatre as well, which is also part of Saddler's Wells, where we have longer-running, more commercial shows like tap shows and Bollywood shows. And it all falls under the umbrella of dance, of course. So
yeah,
that's why we can be so wide-ranging.
Perhaps you should tell us a few of the people who are going to be performing then within the festival that you would kind of particularly put the spotlight on.
So the Isabel Bayon piece, choreographed by Israel Galvan, I think will be very interesting because he's such an interesting contemporary flamenco choreographer who has worked with other contemporary artists like Akram Khan in another piece. Maria Pajes's piece, Yo Carmen, is twisting the traditional view of Carmen, which is through Bizet's opera and other interpretations, generally interpreted by men. One of the focuses of this festival this year is that a lot of the performers are women and a lot of the references are towards a female take on traditional, if you like, traditional structures. It's rather wonderful. It's a bit coincidental that this year also we're celebrating the 100 years, aren't we, of women getting the first right to vote. So I think all this sort of movement towards respecting and listening to the female point of view. And of course, the flamenco world is a little bit traditionally patriarchal. And I think that another highlight I would say related to that is the evening of the gala performance with La Chana, who is this incredible lady in her 70s who a documentary film came out in 2016 about her life, where it documented that in fact she was unable to dance for many years because she was held back by her abusive husband. And she then reinvented her career again and has made a comeback, and she'll be performing on stage at Sadler's Wells, which will be very, very special. And the whole evening is sort of dedicated to her legacy, if you like, and she'll be there as well. So I think that's another highlight. And the film will be screened as well in our studio theatre on one of the other nights.
I'm always intrigued, having been to Sadler's Wells a few times and been to the Pina Bausch performances there. In fact, I'm going this time next week, going to be there with another member of our staff. We talked before about this off air, that it's slightly different from going for the football, but in ways you would not necessarily imagine. And I wondered about the programme notes. There's always an interesting, there's a lot of reading that you can do, but I wonder how much reading you feel that people need to do to tackle, not necessarily something like the Flamenco Festival, but some of the other things that are going to be in your calendar for the rest of the year. The Pina Bausch season, which opens in a couple of days, I understand, at Sadler's Wells. How much sort of curatorial learning people need to do before they go to see something, or whether they can just enjoy it as a pure spectacle?
I think they can do both. We use a lot of, because dance speaks for itself and generally doesn't have language, we use a lot of filming to promote and talk about through the movement, the pieces that we do. We find that we have quite a lot of hits on our website of people watching films of the performances that are coming up to sort of find out about it. And then we sort of see people do book once they've seen what they might be coming to see.
Okay.
Which is quite interesting because it's difficult to explain dance sometimes. You have to watch
it. So that's
nice.
So people are actually wanting to, people are getting the visceral rather than relying on the sort of instructions in the box.
I think that's exactly it. I think the visceral is the experience that I think many people take away from all sorts of dance performances, particularly if it's not a linear narrative dance performance where you're going away with the story, but you're going to see something that doesn't necessarily have a structure as you understand it. But in fact, Pina Bausch is a very good example of that, isn't it? It completely fascinates and intrigues and makes you question what you've just seen. So I think it's an artistic work in the best possible sense.
Katie, thank you so much for talking through the doing what you said couldn't be done in many ways, talking us through dance. The Flamenco Festival 2018, Women and Creation. It starts this Valentine's Day and it's on until the end of the month. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
There we have it, Andrew.
Thank you.
Did you enjoy today's show? We had quite a mixed bag, didn't we?
Yeah, it's good when we do highbrow. I'm always a bit nervous before we do those things because I often wonder how everyone starts off as little kids, but what point is it where you think, I know, I'm going to be a philosopher or I'm going to be a neuroscientist? That, you know, when I was a kid, I wanted to work in a pet shop. That was the thing that
you've
had.
You've gone full circle. Our listeners will not forget the bird box conversation.
Good.
At the beginning of the show, Andrew. You are coming into your own here.
I think that was my big ambition was, you know, I wonder if I could work in a pet shop. That would be so exciting. And there are often, obviously, people are sitting around, you know, thinking, I wonder if I could be a philosopher. That's good, isn't it? What point that strikes you?
Sitting around as a six-year-old kind of going, I think Descartes had it all wrong.
I've got a bit of a feeling that Antonio was thinking that when he was about six.
Yeah, do you think so?
Yeah, I think he's a bit ahead of the game.
He's nice. It's nice to have such an august voice on the Monocle Weekly. Thanks also to all our guests. I can't wait for my date at Sadler's Wells.
I know.
Next week. It's one of those things, you know, when I see dancing on stage, I always kind of think I'm wasted in the seating in the auditorium, Andrew, as you know. But hey, it's Sadler's Wells. It's the home of contemporary dance in the world. Let them eat cake.
I've seen you at the Christmas party.
Let's thank our pals behind the glass. Today's show was, of course, produced by Tom Hall and researched by Louis Harnett O'Mara. And our studio manager was Cassie Galpin. The Monocle Weekly will be back same time, same place. For the time being, from me, Robert Bound.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.